PTSD.
I just say how good it is to be back, y'all. You know, Cass had vacay last week. Feels good to be back.
Welcome.
I was a little bit lonely last Friday.
Were you lonely?
Yeah, I was lonely because you were off being on vacay, so I didn't have my text buddy, and then we didn't have Madtropolis.
JD, did you see? I brought popcorn, beer. I'm ready, you guys. I'm ready for this conversation. Welcome to Matt Gaines Live. I'm Cassandra Gaines, and today we are going to talk about a very, very hot topic. Accidents, insurance, who's at fault, what do we do, where do we go from now? Because we have a big freaking problem in our country, and we need to address it. So here is what we're going to do. Nothing at Madtropolis is narrow-minded. Everything in our industry is incredibly complex. So for those of you out there that are saying to themselves, oh, fuck plaintiff attorneys, they're the problem. This is the reason I'm paying these high insurance premiums. Blah, 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 blah. Nope. Mm-mm. I'm going to prove otherwise today.
Oh, he came prepared.
So I'm going to prove otherwise today. And then as we all know, as we all have work and are working in the trucking industry, the population likes to say, fuck truckers. They're the ones killing all the families. They're the ones that are horrible on the street. They're ruining the world, blah, 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 which nope, mm-mm, that's wrong too. So today we're going to talk about many points along those lines, but we're also going to tell you quite a bit of things you don't know that goes behind the scenes with some of these verdicts from some of these big nuclear verdicts you've been seeing. So some of you saw my post on LinkedIn where you saw a major Werner verdict that we're going to talk about, and then an accident that I want to talk about as well that involves a truck driver watching porn and killing a bunch of people, which happens. Hey, Joe Fried, how often does this happen?
I don't know how often it happens, but I've personally been involved in at least half a dozen crashes, very, very major crashes where truckers were confirmed watching porn.
It happens. So everybody's at fault. We're going to fix this. We're going to find out. There's some things in there. There's things behind the curtain that are going on that you guys don't know about that also drive some of these big verdicts and some of these high insurance premiums. So Joe, you start, explain to us who you are. And thank you, by the way, for coming on. It took some serious, serious courage to come into the lion's den, but we're not like that. We will prove that to you today. And you will prove to us today why plaintiff attorneys understand our industry. And they also have similar viewpoints.
I'll start off. First of all, my name is Joe Fried. I'm a plaintiff's attorney. My practice is out of Atlanta, Georgia, although I practice all over the country. I think I've handled trucking cases in, I think, 37 states now and growing. I spend a lot of time not only in the handling of cases, but a huge part of my world has to do with teaching other lawyers and sort of, frankly, leading the plaintiff's bar in what are the appropriate and best ways and best practices that we have as attorneys to handle these kinds of cases. So to those of you who have a natural inclination against, quote, the plaintiff's lawyers out there, I'm probably public enemy number one. What I hope that you'll see by the end of this is that we probably have a lot more in common than we are going to have some differences, though. Mm-hmm. And I don't want anybody, not that I have to say this on anything that Cassandra is involved in, but don't hold anything back. Whatever your feelings are, you're entitled to them. And let's talk about them for real. Right now. So. Uh-huh. Bring them.
I got my trucking accident expert, Brendan, who also is very famous in Madtropolis. But for those of you who don't know you, could you introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about you and your company?
Yes, thank you, Cassandra. It's a privilege to be here, privilege to be on with Joe Fried and J.D. Redman and the rest of Madtropolis. My name is Brendan Dawson. I'm the Dragon Slayer, founder and CEO of Accident Plan. Dragon Slayer is a term that applies today when we get into reptile theory. And I come from a trucking safety and operations background. So every conversation there is to be had with a driver, whether it happened at 2 o'clock in the morning or Sunday afternoon, I've had. And after 25 years in trucking, it occurred to me that most of our accident responses in trucking are reactive and defensive and tends to leave the motor carrier flat-footed and on their back foot when they're trying to defend a claim. And I also, and really nobody, not very many people know this until today, but I also do a side hustle as a private investigator. And so I've investigated accidents from both sides, from the defense side and the plaintiff's bar. And within those investigations, I've discovered, and it's been an observation, that plaintiffs usually come across more prepared, and they're prepared right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. And defense is always on its back foot. And so we built accident plan as our effort to the trucking industry, something I'm very passionate about, to help sort of turn that tide and put the motor carrier on a stronger foot when they move forward to defending their accident claims.
Good. You're perfect. JD Redman. Yeah, you, JD. So when you were, I don't know, brushing your hair and making sure you look all good, or doing whatever, push-ups, I don't know what you were doing before you got on Zoom, but everybody missed you, and they were like, where's JD? We're waiting for JD. And I was like,
oh, gosh.
So tell us who you are, and make sure, just so you guys know, I kept JD in the dark as usual, mainly because I want to see what he has to say about some of the stuff. Is it an inhaler? What is it?
It is my inhaler.
I'm sorry, man.
Good old albuterol.
So introduce yourself, my friend, to anybody who doesn't know you. Like, everybody knows you, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, gosh. I'm JD Redman. I'm Cassandra's buddy. That's really what it is. She's one of my really good friends. And So I wanted to help support her. This is your first time watching the show. I wanted to help support her with the show off air. Like, I was never trying to be in this position whatsoever. And some kind of way we did it, and it just kind of worked. And I work in marketing for TTN. I'm trying to make sure that we help with breakdowns. So I'm interested in this conversation because we touch accidents a lot on our side as far as trying to ensure we help mitigate the exposure to the spin. So I'm interested to see what comes out of this. I have no clue what Cassandra's going to say or do, which makes me nervous. But nonetheless, we're here. So thank you, Cassandra.
It. Thank you.
You think you're nervous.
You just never know with her, Joe. She asked me a question about a month ago, and the way I answered it was the right answer, but it was the wrong answer for the question, and it still got me in trouble. So I was just like, I don't know what to do. Like, I don't.
Everybody knows. They're starting to get the hang of how I'm operating. But it's good. We get more authenticity when I bring people in and they're a little bit blind. So let's start right away. Joe, you're going to be on the hot seat right away because I know some people have never even seen a plaintiff attorney in their life. They're like, holy crap, one actually came on to our show and they want to talk to us. So we're excited to have you. But let's hit this right off the bat. So Werner, we all know the trucking company.
Yep.
They had a verdict against them. And just from a high level, I'm going to give you guys very quick points. If you want to read the whole thing, it's in my feed, or one of my friends here will probably repost the article. But it's a major verdict. I think it was like $40 million. A woman in her pickup truck was driving along the road, highway, on the other side of the highway where the Werner truck was coming. She lost control because of icy conditions. She spun through the median. She hits a Werner truck. Werner truck wasn't driving fast, wasn't doing anything reckless, no citations. Huge verdict against Werner. So Joe, everybody in the industry, except for me, said, what the hell happened here? And I think we need you to give us some guidance. You don't have to talk about specifically, because this isn't your case. You don't have to talk about specifically this lawsuit, but this happens quite a bit where truckers feel like they didn't do anything wrong, and then they're getting slapped with a big verdict. And everybody's blindsided in the industry, kind of saying, what?
That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, that case is an interesting case. And, you know, and obviously you pitched it the way you pitched it. I think the plaintiff's lawyer in that case, the way he pitched it was, this was a trainee. He was a trainee who was relatively early in the training program, who was unsupervised, driving a just-in-time load in icy conditions that were icy for a long time. He was going over 60 miles an hour in a location where there were around the area where this happened, there were over 100 crashes. And Werner testified that they knew about the weather conditions, never informed the driver or the driver supervisor about them, and did not didn't and made no accommodations for the just-in-time load, and then testified in front of the jury that they've learned absolutely nothing from this wreck, and that they weren't going to do anything different as a result of what happened in this wreck, despite the fact that one child was killed, another child was horribly brain injured, mom and dad were both injured, mom was injured, and another child was really seriously injured. So when you hear the facts from that perspective, you can at least hopefully understand. You may still disagree with the result and say, well, that doesn't change that mom drove through the median. But a lot of times,
the vehicle, what the fuck was she doing on the road? You know, everybody's saying that, but then you could turn around and say to the trucking company, what the fuck were you doing on the road?
Exactly. And so, look, I'm not here to get, I wasn't at the trial. I'm very familiar with the case, and I was familiar with it before it went to trial. Because what you'll learn if you ask me is we're all very connected on our side. And most of the big things that you see happen are really a concerted effort by a lot of people who are working together to try to bring about change. That case was selected essentially as a case to try to bring about change in the industry that has to do with making sure that drivers are given appropriate information about weather conditions, if and that companies who have the capacity to do it are monitoring weather and pushing that information out from a safety perspective. I look at every case I have from the perspective of the driver. Mm-hmm. If I'm a driver in that situation, I sure as hell don't want to be involved, whether I'm responsible or not. I don't want to be involved in a freaking crash that I have to live with for the rest of my life that somebody died and got maimed in. I think drivers deserve to get all the information that they can, especially if the motor carriers have them. By the way, in that case, I believe that the reason the verdict went so high is not because of Werner or the driver. I believe the way that case was defended by the lawyers defending them drove that verdict. You know, they had everybody deny that there was even bad weather out there, despite there were 14 witnesses. Wow. There were 14 witnesses who testified about the weather conditions. There was national weather advisories and warnings in place at the time and had been for 12 hours, and they're denying the obvious. Now, some of you, if you lay aside for a second the bend toward the trucking side, which, by the way, I share with you, it pisses me off when we have a small group of people within this incredible industry that gives the industry a black eye. But sometimes, you know, sometimes when people do things wrong, you got to stand up and address it. You got to be open about it. You got to be admitting it. I'll say this real quick, and I know we got to get onto something else, Cassandra, but you know, when people talk about nuclear verdicts, the first thing I do is I distinguish between, are we talking about just a big verdict? Because some cases are big. I mean, when you have a $30 million life care plan to take care of somebody and you get a $40 million verdict, it's on the abstract, it sounds huge, $40 million. But if it's going to cost $30 million to take care of the person, the $40 million verdict's not that big. The things that people are pissed off about, I think, are the ones that I call outperform verdicts. You think it's X. Fairness says it's X, and it ends up being 20X. And in cases like that, what I always say to folks on your side of the fence is, obviously the jury reacted to something other than the damages. So you want to blame me.
Right.
And, you know, I learned a long time ago, my mama taught me, when I point a finger, I'm pointing three fingers back at myself.
Oh, okay.
So you got to at least ask yourself, you got to at least consider, what is it that they reacted to? And if I have ideas about that, I'm happy to share, but I'm just pointing that out on the front end, and it probably pisses some people off, but you know, that's just, and by the way, I'm also not going to sit here and say that my side of the fence is perfect. And we all know that the justice system is far from perfect. Mm-hmm. It's not perfect. We do the best we can, but it's not perfect. And there's going to be some errors going in both directions within the system.
And at Madtropolis, we, especially JD and I, we love having uncomfortable conversations because that means that we're growing. We don't want to sit here and all preach to each other the same opinion. And unless it's about music. But here's what I'll say. Brendan, you're up. Why are trucks on the road when the weather is bad? Why are they even using chains? Why do truck drivers feel the pressure to continue to drive? Oh, playing additional music for you guys. What is your advice to your trucking companies on this topic to avoid this type of verdict? Which is clear that our country views safety differently than the trucking industry does, by the way. Like, our country is saying truck drivers get the F off the road, and truck drivers are like, I got to deliver your goods. What are you talking about?
Yeah, and there's a lot going on here, and one of the first things is that Joe Fried mentioned is one of the things this hurts so emotionally on a road level is that it's beginning to dispel a myth that there's a correlation between fault and liability. And there really, in this case, there no longer is, because what Joe described were the circumstances, the mitigating circumstances. But at the core fact of the situation was the driver was doing his job under the speed limit for the conditions. He was in complete control of his unit when the other unit was completely out of control. And so if you just think of it in terms of the, and I know it's not a binary equation, Joe, I respect that, but when one's in control and one's out of control, it should leave somebody in the clear, and the rest is all mitigating circumstance. Now, back to your question, Cassandra, and what should the trucking industry do if it snows? Well, you can be certain, and if this whole COVID thing didn't open people's eyes to it, and you can even get Ron Kane in on this part of the discussion, but if all the trucks shut down every time it snowed, it's a very short period of time before there's no food, no goods, no gloves, no mittens, no fuel for anything to do. And so commerce has always traveled in harder conditions. Now, sometimes those conditions get bad enough that you have to stop. But then as soon as you can go again, you get going because the wheels turn. And it's not like we're doing it just for the money. Right. There is, and it is that cause of getting those goods to the company. So you can't tell them to shut down because you'll go broke shutting down, and you won't be there, and the trucks won't be there. It's everything's operating on such a thin margin. So my advice, as it pertains to this particular Werner case, is make sure your procedures are tight and that your policies are tight. Because unless I'm mistaken, Joe, they went back into the Werner policy handbook and pulled those policies out and said, well, it says here in your policy that you were supposed to do this, and you didn't do that. So make sure your policies are saying what you need to do, and then you're doing what those policies say. And so those are the two pieces of advice. And
I want to pause right there for everybody who's on the call. That's a trucking company or a broker or a shipper. Make sure you check those policies, because those are the first thing that Joe reaches for, because he wants to understand what are your standards about safety at your drop off and pickup spaces, about safety and driving, about how you select a motor carrier. So just wanted to pause there for a learning moment that no one really wants. Joe, how much of these big verdicts are not quite due to the facts of the case? They're more due to the handling of the case.
Well, I think there's two parts of that. I don't know how to quantify the answer, but I can tell you that in my practice, I look for a way, frankly, to I look for whether this is a case that the driver actually is a victim. The truck driver is a victim of poorly run trucking company. Because from my perspective and in my experience, frankly, jurors are much more willing to get angry at a trucking company than they are an individual who's out there working their asses off.
That's a good point.
Trying to pay the bills. And, you know, I'll tell you, I sit across the table almost weekly from a driver who is responsible for killing, maybe the allegation is that they're responsible for killing or maiming somebody.
Thanks for the qualifier, Joe.
And I'll tell you that I cry with them in deposition sometimes. And I'm not saying that to be melodramatic,
No, I know you're not.
These drivers, they're not listened to. They've not been heard. I'm the first person who's actually letting them tell their story, and they're scared shitless to tell it because their lawyers have beat the shit out of them and told them, just say this, just say this, and just say this. So I'm the first person who's willing to listen to their story. I'm the first person that finds out what the pressure's like. I don't know, and I don't want to be accused of trying to put facts into this Werner case that I don't know about. I'm not an expert in that case. I'm familiar with it, but I can tell you that if you're a brand new freaking driver trainee in a case and you've been told you're on a just-in-time load and you've got your supervisor, your person who's supposed to be sitting in the front with you, who's sleeping in the sleeper berth, and they're not up there, you're not gonna I just talk to drivers, okay? But you know how many a trainee is gonna wake their damn supervisor up in the back and say, "Get your ass up here, because I need somebody sitting beside me." It ain't happening. How many is calling in to dispatch and saying, "Can you push back this load for me? Because I know it's just in time, but shit, the weather conditions out here suck. And I'm supposed to be a professional driver." That is not freaking happening. And I'm sorry, you guys may disagree with me, but I think companies need to appreciate that and know that and protect their drivers from being in those kinds of situations. So that's one thing, and I'm sorry I'm going on and on, but Cassandra, the other part of your question is how many of these cases are about how the cases are defended. Let me challenge, I don't know how many thousands of people are watching you and will be watching you, but here's the challenge I've given when I've spoken to the American Trucking Association, when I've spoken to the Defense Research Institute and other industry groups. My challenge is this: all of you who know so much about this industry, call us in, tell us about the cases that you know about that are what you call nuclear verdicts that start with an admission of fault. Tell me about it, and I'll sit here and wait, because I'll challenge
you.
An admission of fault.
Yeah, okay, we're going to pause there for just a moment. I want you guys to understand this, because what he's saying blew my freaking mind when I started litigating.
This is actually the conference that I ended up meeting Cassandra as the result of. Mm-hmm. I spoke to a room full of defense people. They were all lawyers or claims people specific to trucking. There were over 700 people in the audience, and I was asked to speak about why I think nuclear verdicts are happening. And one of the things I said was, all right, there's 750 people in here. Somebody raise your hand and tell me about a nuclear verdict that started with an admission of responsibility, an admission of fault. We did something wrong, and nobody could raise their frickin' hand. So what does that tell you? It tells you that one of the things that people are reacting to out there is as simple as whether you're willing to own up to something that was done wrong in the case. By contrast, the case that you're choosing as the poster child case, this Werner case, you had people come in and said, "We ain't learned shit from this, and we're not going to change anything about it.
How disrespectful.
Not do anything about it."
Right? I'll tell you that okay, so for those of you who are like, what the hell are they talking about? All right, here's a perfect example. Werner had another lawsuit. I'm not banging on Werner, but they just had two really bad ones recently, where their driver, man, I wish I could remember, crossed the median, and he hit a family head on. And they wouldn't admit they did something wrong. Trucking companies do this all the time. They refuse to admit they did something wrong. Truck driver will be drunk, truck driver's speeding, truck driver's on the cell phone, hurt somebody. Their insurance company, their defense attorneys, they're like, "We're not going to admit fault. We are going to," which means saying, "Yes, we're liable. We agree. We hurt you. We hurt somebody. We are so sorry. Now let's focus on what is your client's injuries and what are the damages and how much are we going to pay?" So it's an amazing strategy. And it's insurance.
I thought truck drivers were their lifeline. I thought truck drivers were the lifeline, and we loved our truck drivers. We protect our truck drivers, and we wouldn't be anywhere without them. Like, you're telling them.
It's true, but when they do something wrong, it's okay. It happens. And what you do is, as a lawyer, you're supposed to, I think, this is Cassandra's world. JD, it's up to you whether you want to open the floor at the end, and you can let in anyone you want. There are a lot of really good attorneys, defense attorneys that are on here, and industry people. But when it's your time to say, "I fucked up, what do I owe you? What do I owe you?" Because then the anger's gone. and
it changes.
There's nothing wrong with doing something wrong.
It changes the equation from the jury having to say, I can't let them get away with this. They don't even think that they've done is wrong. Think about it in your own life when somebody's done something wrong to you. I mean, it's almost like the fact that they did it wrong to you is not nearly as important to you. What makes you want to go find a baseball bat and take it to the side of their car is that they won't admit it. And they throw it back in your face and said, no, you know what? I mean, these people are flippant. And so it shouldn't be any surprise to people when the jury reacts, just like, I mean, that's just a human response. You know what? You want to play that game? I'll teach you a lesson.
And sometimes drivers don't even, they're like, I did something wrong. What is going on here? Go ahead, Brandon. I see you, Brandon.
So what do they do? So what do they do here? Because I am very, very, very green in this scenario. So the driver is at fault or not at fault, right? So if the driver's over here and now you're saying that hypothetically Werner is now not admitting fault and are separating from the driver, is the driver just left alone to defend themselves, or does Werner still protect the driver? Like, what I'm confused about that separation.
The driver is named in the suit.
Mm-hmm, personally.
Werner and the motor carrier is named vicariously. And because the plaintiff side knows that the driver has no assets, so they sue the motor carrier vicariously. So the motor carrier and the driver have to go through it together. As goes the driver, so goes the carrier. Joe's point, and here's Joe's point in a nutshell for the motor carriers out there: if it doesn't go to trial, you can't have a nuclear verdict.
Mm-hmm.
So keep it out of the courtroom.
This is where
motor carriers are getting caught flat-footed, and this is where you have to suspend a sense of justice, because the fact of the case is the only thing that driver did wrong that day was showing up for work. He's just doing his job to the best of his ability, and they are hammering the drivers over this. And so the driver's actions were actually not on trial. Werner's policies and Werner's operations were on trial, and they lost. And they lost because of their documentation and the way they outlined their policy manual. And they lost, and I believe this, as Joe said, in large part due to bad lawyering. And I've just read everything I could on it.
A trucking attorney. Joe met me because I'm a defense trucking attorney, is what I do for a living, or I used to do. Joe, let's spin it on your head.
Right. You know, look at it, and they go, no, our driver didn't do anything wrong. Okay, but you put him on the road. You could have put him on I-10 instead of I-20. It was snowing. You could have done
sent him a Qualcomm message telling him to still drive.
Mm-hmm. You have a duty, right? You have a duty to operate safely. And so that's why Werner lost it. And this is where motor carriers are. The strategy now, and this is something else that came out in the ATRI report this week, is that plaintiffs use strategy. Defense uses tactics. And so if you can apply a strategy that says keep it out of the hands of Joe Freed, sorry, Joe.
That's okay. I've been called worse probably on this show by people. So,
but keep it away. And getting ahead of these claims and not letting them get out there. It's a risk, and it's a risk that has to be evaluated in trucking, just like everything.
So should the company admit guilt then? I mean, that's the question over there in the comments.
Here's my point, and I agree with 90% of what Brendan said. I'm not going to go so far as to say the truck driver didn't do something that warrants some degree of responsibility. But oftentimes what I'm suggesting is that the driver's doing the best they can within the training and the policies and the practices of the motor carrier. And so they are, in a sense, coming and doing what's expected of them by the motor carrier. And that's the problem. So that if they were left to their own good suggested, practice, they would have probably acted differently. But so what I'm suggesting is I'm going to flip it around. When my person has some responsibility in a case, I'm the first person bringing that shit out. Mm. I'm coming from at the outset, folks. You know, I remember getting up in a case not long ago in the Southeast, getting up and saying my client was intoxicated. My client may have jumped a red light, and my client may have been in the process, in the midst of doing a drug deal at the time this crash occurred. I want you to know that at the beginning. So does that make you wonder why I'm in this case?
Because he's not making this stuff up.
Okay. Why am I in this case? So what if I were to tell you the reason I'm in this case is because this case is against a trucking company that's running 800 trucks mm-hmm. through our community every month. And they have some really dangerous practices that I believe need to be addressed. And that's why I'm here. Now, notice what I've done. I've given the jurors a reason to understand that this case is about something that's much bigger and more important than even potentially my client, right? And so Brendan's going crazy right now because he's saying
you're pulling on the heartstrings, man. You're pulling on the heartstrings.
But let me finish real quick. The truck driver in that case, what the truck driver did was bad. I mean, I could get in all the details about it, and what the trucking company did. I promise you, if I went into the details, all of y'all would get real quiet and not want to talk about this case.
Sure. Okay?
But what was going to happen in that case was if I didn't own all the shit on my side, the jury never would have been able to see by it. So imagine what happens in the Werner case if they get up in that case and they say, you know, folks, you know, we've learned from this. This was brought to our, you know, blah, 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 blah. Maybe we should be doing more about these things, about whether this is what the industry standard is, which isn't really to monitor weather constantly. But, you know, maybe the industry should, maybe we're learning from this, blah, blah, blah. But let me tell you, in this case, why it's not not what caused this crash to occur. But in clearer cases where you've got somebody who, I mean, I have cases where truck drivers run into the back of families of three and four people and kill them. And those cases are defended to the jury, where somebody comes up and runs the hell into the back of somebody, you know, with never hitting their brakes. And I'm sorry, you can't defend that case. No. I mean, it's not defensible. You
and
want to
I see
defend
people
it.
In the comments, they're already making arguments. I would tell the jury to do this, or I would argue this. You've just missed his point. Mm-hmm. If you're arguing, you missed his point because you've missed the number one rule, is in trial, trucking companies lose. So you can't compare them and you can't make a jury think, how would you feel if you did this, and blah, blah, blah. It doesn't work like that. They're already going in with their own trucking anger. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Brendan.
Well, there's a lot going on here. And
sure.
Joe made a great point about the accusation audit. You have to own your mistakes. And if you don't own your mistakes, you're not going to get there. The part I don't agree with right now, Cassandra, is that trucking can't win in a case. And one of the things I'm wondering, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but what happens when you take those pathos style arguments, and can you turn it around? Maybe Joe, you can answer this, because there's an emotional side to that driver. In that case, there's a very emotional plea on that. And then there's emotional plea to the jury that suggests that here's the statistics and all we're doing is running up the price of milk with this. And then to Joe's point about owning the client who was drunk and dealing drugs and all of these things, whose world would two wrongs make a right?
Yeah. Let me back up though. The things that Joe and I are talking about is mm-hmm. when the facts are bad.
Yeah.
And it's not, you are not going to make any progress arguing against really bad facts.
Well, yeah, then why are you
it's
taking
not
it?
Trucking company, like there are going to be other times where there are arguments that somebody else is at fault, and then you're golden. You can make the
why
argument.
Does it ever get to a courtroom? When the facts are bad, why does it ever get into a courtroom, Joe? You said it yourself, a rear ender's indefensible.
It is.
And it is. I agree with you.
Unless you have an outward-facing camera where somebody cut you off. Remember those people? Remember the people who go in front of you and cut you off and then
all the time. By the way, I'm also a CDL holder, just so you know. I put in a few
Get it.
Well, Brendan, I'm a driver trainer, so that makes us almost
I knew you actually had to
go. I went to Cornell University. I said that for
I grew up in Louisiana in the country.
So you know how to eat, Ben. You know how to eat, baby.
I can make some good boudin if you need some.
So here's the point. The point that I'm making, I think trucking can absolutely win. I think there's got to be a shift in the whole mentality. Here's what's going on. I mean, when I started working in trucking stuff 15 years ago, the plaintiff's bar was discombobulated. We didn't know what the federal regulations were. We didn't know what the CDL manual was. We didn't know what drivers were supposed to do. And we treated these cases as car cases. And experienced lawyers on the other side would run right over us. And honestly, I sat there and made a decision one day that this was going to become my field. And I knew that to do it, I needed to become I needed to become a subject matter expert, you know, in that field. Since then, now, fast forward to now, 15 years later, the plaintiff's bar is much more organized than the defense bar, and we're motivated to help each other. On the defense side, you guys have a bunch of lawyers who are insular. You don't share because you think if you share, you're going to go to a conference and someone's going to steal your damn client and is going to show them that they have a better mousetrap than you do. And so there's no sharing of information. It's all held proprietary. And you think that that's helping you and your cause.
Don't forget about our cheap-ass rates, by the way. Our rates, you guys, defense lawyers don't make any money on stuff. Like, it's not, we're not out there making money off this stuff.
It's a cost-based model. And the plaintiff is a profit-based model. And I'll take what Joe said a little step further about lawyers not, attorneys not sharing their information. It goes further than that. The motor carrier is trying to keep things from their insurance carrier. And then that insurance carrier is also trying to, you know, they're also filtering what they put down the line. So that information is getting delayed and filtered all the way down the line. And each time, every time you can't control that narrative, somebody like Joe is going to control that narrative for you. And so there's an inherent mistrust in the relationship between the insured and the insurance, and that carries all the way down the line.
See, that's where I play in. I play in that with the insurance part. And the insurance portion of it, we run into some crazy things where I was talking with Jolly this morning where you have people that will doctor their policies. And as they are now claiming or going into relationships, they only have $100,000 in coverage or let's say $1 million in coverage and they needed $5 million. So they go in and doctor the policy to show that they have $5 million. We're seeing those types of things. Or when accidents take place, here's $1,000, Mr. Police Officer. Say it didn't happen today on Friday. Say it happened on Saturday and you know, accidentally fat finger or, you know, right in the wrong date. I've seen some of those things, but you guys are kind of blowing my mind with the fact that you're not seeing carriers admitting fault. I'm confused by that portion of this, of them not saying, hey, guys, you know what? Yep.
JD.
It's us.
JD, let me make something really clear. I believe, now I've never been a defense lawyer, so Cassandra can call me out on this, but I believe a lot of times that's a lawyer invented defense, not a motor carrier defense. The motor carrier would just assume be straight up.
And, it's old school. JD, you know our industry is so old school. It's an old school tactic.
Okay.
Deny.
Yeah.
So how do you change that? I mean, that.
I'll tell you exactly how what I do is when something is clear cut or is going to look really bad to a juror in that county, I admit fault. And then we dive right into, okay, what are our damages here? How do we mitigate it? How do we truly take care of people? So Jason asked this question too. I know this sounds cheesy, but ask yourself if you were somebody who's injured the way they've been injured, how can you resolve this but be a person still? And that's very hard for defense attorneys because let's not forget that a defense attorney might say, okay, we've done something wrong here. We need to admit liability. And on top of that, here's how much I think we need to pay and how we pay it. But the insurers will have a different opinion.
Oh, that's so important, Cassandra.
The trucking company will have a different opinion. And then you've got a situation where the driver, the trucking company, and the defense attorney are all defending a loser case with loser arguments And but that's often
how except don't put them together because they're way apart from each other.
Well, sorry.
And they're, you know, I can't tell you, especially in recent years with the much larger cases that I've been involved in over the years, the trucking company becomes my ally, frankly, against the insurance company who's trying to defend. Yeah. The trucking company wants the hell out. The insurance company doesn't want to come up with the money. You know, I mean,
the insurance company's calling me and they're saying, JD, do an investigation on how that accident was managed and mitigated. Show me how much it cost. Show me was that the true cost. Show me who was at fault. Were there any under table money going on? Because that accident, I know we're talking insurance side, but that accident, the portion of the cleanup, if it was an environmental cleanup, if it was a hazard cleanup, that right there could be 50, 60, 70,000, 100,000, 200,000. So you guys are on point.
Brendan?
Another key fact in this is that oftentimes the motor carrier and the insurance company are owned by the same entity. And that's one of the things that's given rise to this, because you've got captive insurance groups and you've got risk retention mm-hmm. groups that are out there.
Really do know
and they're not
area,
they're not swimming in the same pool, in the same Great West pool. So for all the conventional insurance product people who are on the show today, that's one of the eventual remedies, is that they pool their own money into a captive, and so that loss pool belongs to them. And if they don't draw from that loss pool over time, they get to take the revenue from that loss pool. And so though in that arrangement, it's a different paradigm, a different mindset of the insurance. Does that ever play in your calculus, Joe?
Yes.
Sure. All the time. I agree 100%.
I have a question for Joe now. Let's spin this whole conversation because JD and I have had, as this show tends to snowball and get bigger and bigger, we're collecting more and more shippers. Our shipper population is growing very fast. I think they are quite lonely in their companies that don't understand transportation. And they're like, oh, friends. Joe, what's going on with litigation? Are you looking to shippers? Are you looking to brokers? Because trucking companies only have 750,000, maybe a million. Most of the time it's a million. Let's just be real, folks. They have a million in auto. When you've killed three people, or you don't even have to kill people. $1 million is almost nothing these days. Do you look
killing people is cheaper? Killing people is cheaper than maiming people.
That's such a good point. It is
because of the cost that. Of it care. Is. Cost of care is what drives these.
Is there going to be a cost of care capped at a year?
No, for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. No, so like, I mean, I just finished a case where legitimately no BS. I mean, even the defense, the argument was whether it was going to cost $27 or $32 million to take care of this young man for the rest of his life. The defense's position was $27 million. My expert was saying $32 million, but I was frankly, you know, that's the range. It was the right range. That, you know, so those are real numbers, and that's not going to a plaintiff. That's going to take care of. That's going to take care of somebody. So it's going to medical facilities. So it can be huge numbers of huge numbers.
You guys want to know what else is really sad? Is that if you injure or kill somebody who's above the age of 75 or below the age of like 25, value of the case is lower too.
Yeah, I'm trying to change that, Cassandra.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. You might imagine that.
MRI, they said cases involving minors are vastly higher. So the children, and that's one of the things that drove the heartstrings in the Werner situation, is there was a serious.
But for Brendan, it's really hard to settle those cases.
Yeah.
It's because we're looking to valuation, and I mean, it's like this big gap between settlement and what the jury verdict would be.
I mean, we could do a whole show on how the cases ought to be valued, which would actually be an interesting thing to get everybody's perspective mm-hmm. on. But, you know, I'm trying to remember exactly what your question was. Oh, it was about shipper. It was about shippers and brokers. And so, look, I know, and we all know, that pretty much anybody who touches the transportation cycle, if you've made some money out of the transaction, what's taught on my side of the fence is follow the money. So if I can follow the money of who made money on a load, it's very easy to convince people to that if you're making money on something, you ought to have some responsibility for the process. And I don't do a lot of broker and shipper cases by choice. I mean, but I'm aware of them, and I'm involved in the, on the plaintiff side, thinking through those cases. So I'll tell you, if you're a broker or shipper, you should be banging the drum for higher insurance limits for motor carriers, because the main reason that somebody's coming after you is because there's not enough coverage on the motor carrier. I mean, if I can keep the case simple and keep sort of all barrels of the shotgun pointed at the most clear cut area where there is liability, then I don't go up the line, and nobody on my side would. You'll never, in fact, I would venture to say, and I would again challenge people who are brokers here or shippers, if you guys have significant litigation against you, my bet is go back and look at the underlying carriers on the motor, the coverage on the motor carrier, and you're going to find that it was insufficient to take care of whatever the perceived damages are, whether it's a death or serious injury. And so that's the only reason why I'm going to complicate my case, make my life harder for longer, have to take more depositions, have to put out more money for more experts.
Well, what about the carrier who's having to put out more money for having their premiums increase?
Brutal.
So now we can have a conversation on where responsibility should lie and what values should be.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's part of what's happening with this new move to to increase limits. But, you know, look, and we can have differences of agreement, JD, on where, on what amounts ought to be available to people in lawsuits. But what I'm talking about right now is really more of an allocation question.
Mm-hmm.
People on the motor carrier side will come back and say, well, you know, wait a minute, they made money on me. And, you know, I know you guys had all kinds of knockdown dragouts on, are you treating each other right, fairly or not, between carriers and brokers and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes the answer is yes. And sometimes maybe there's a perception of some parties that there's some mistreatment in there.
Are we looking at the end of owner operators and small carriers with this increase? Are we only going to start to see the Schneiders and the JB Hunts, the Werners, the Knight Swifts? Are we only going to see these big players from now on if this does go forward, because smaller carriers can't afford to carry that type of insurance?
Brendan, what's been the vibe, Brendan, in your community with this? Because many of the mid-size to large carriers don't give a shit about this change.
Yep.
$2 million is nothing.
They want the change.
Yeah, their SRIs, on a larger carrier, their single incident retention is going to be in the $1 to $10 million, $2 to $10 million, $5 to $10 million. So you're right; it's not going to affect the larger carriers, and it will affect the smaller carriers, the ones, twos, to tens, to twenties, especially the new entrants, because that new entrant premium is extremely high these days. And anybody who doesn't have some kind of really strong safety program backing them up, whether they have two trucks or 20,000, is going to pay the price on that. So yeah, JD, I don't know. I don't think we're going to get to a position where there's only the enterprise carriers, but if this goes through, there's going to be a lot of attrition. There's already a lot of attrition based just on insurance premiums across the board, especially in conventional products. And so that's causing some attrition, because by the time they get it, by the time a motor carrier gets in that position, they're out. Their insurance carrier either won't renew them, or they'll increase them by 40, 50, 60%, put them in a special group W, and or sometimes the insurance carriers are just getting out of the market altogether. Because they can't manage it. And so it's just a flat footed situation, you know, something Joe said last week was, sometimes he thinks the trucking industry is its own worst enemy. And I think this is an example of that. And that's what we're trying to change. JD, you asked how we're changing it. Well, we're trying to change it today, and the evolution is coming. it's going to be a part of it. So there will be attrition. So
I'm looking at the supply chain. I'm looking at higher rates means higher insurance premiums could equate to higher rates, which would then equate to less capacity because you don't have as many players in the field, which were already having constrained capacity due to COVID. I didn't mean to cut you off, Cassandra. Go ahead.
You actually said, keep going. Like you said it. Like let me ask the hard question from you guys, including you, JD. And you can say pass, but I'm going to roast you for it, but you can say it. Do we have a bottom feeder problem? I sent out an article to the group. I also posted it on LinkedIn of a guy driving, watching porn, smashing into the back of a bunch of people. This happens all the time. We have drunk drivers still on the road. We have truck drivers who are on drugs. We have a lot of these problems. Mind you guys, we also have really good trucking companies that are doing a great job too. If we increase the insurance premium, will we maybe lose some of that bottom feeder population? Will things be better for us? Or are we losing some really good carriers too, Brendan?
It's hard to say. The bottom feeders will come back. They call them chameleons. They lose a bunch of money. They get their safety rating goes, and they can't get any freight. So they close down their company and they restart under a new DOT number. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things.
Insurance is so expensive they can't even get in and do that anymore.
Are we
doing something good?
So there's got to be a way to filter out the bottom feeders, and there's. You know, there's an argument to be made for this change in insurance requirements. Like I said, I watched four people die in a runaway accident, and there was $750,000 behind the motor carrier. And that's not gonna pay for the rescue effort. So, the other thing they do is even if it goes up to $2 million. You just make sure that all your assets are in a separate account, a separate business, or a separate ownership. So fine, they take the policy limits, shut it all down, move along. And that's why some of these larger companies have such high insurance, is because they're protecting the assets that they have. Because for the plaintiff, Joe, if I'm correct, if there's not enough limit on the policy, you're going to go behind that policy and find out everything they own, where all their assets, and you're going to start dipping into that pot, aren't you?
Well, the answer is I'm going to at least look. Mm-hmm. whether I can do it or not is a question. But you know, I mean, I think we have to put some context into this a little bit. And I know it's hard to. Sometimes there are bitter pills that need to be swallowed, and you can say go to hell, Joe, and that's fine. That's you're entitled to your position. But if we go back to the beginning of this, in 1980 is when these insurance rates went in as part of deregulation. As part of that, they were supposed to go up by cost of living periodically. They've never gone up. So for 40 years, we've had the same minimum limits. At the time they went into play, part of the reason for setting them what was high at the time, you can imagine the Madtropolis, you know, if there would have been that back then, people would be raising hell at 750 back then. That was when 750 bought some stuff. Okay. I mean, it was a lot. Mm-hmm. If it had gone up, I happen to have the statistics here, just by consumer inflation, it would be 2.33 million right now. If it went up by medical inflation, it would be 4.99 million right now. That's without, but the problem is we've just never gone up. Now, the reason that was there was the things you guys are talking about. 750 was high at the time because, and this is right in the Federal Register. Don't take my word for it. There was an understanding. There was an appreciation at the time that with deregulation, there would be a lot more carriers out there. We would not have the law enforcement capacity to do new entrant reviews fast enough and thoroughly enough to protect the public. So what are we going to do? We're going to put a high amount on there, and that what's going to happen is it's Reaganomics. We're going to have the insurance industry police the trucking industry. Oh, and if trucking companies didn't have adequate safety in place and a documentable history of that, then they weren't going to be able to get insurance for decent rates, And it would be a barrier to those companies. And it was designed to be a barrier to those companies. So it's hard to look at it right now and say, we're going from 750 to 2 million. Jeez, man, that's a huge increase. But folks, let me tell you something. Joe Freed drives around with $20 million worth of insurance. Now that may have reflect on how I drive, and y'all don't hold that against me, but
hey, I'm right there with you, baby, whipping and dipping lanes.
But let me tell you something. It's 750 per accident, not per person. So I hate to be the plaintiff lawyer here, but God forbid it's your family. God forbid it's the person who you care about most in your life. It's probably not even yourself. Who do you care about most in your life? And now they have $25 million worth of legitimate needs they're going to need for the rest of their life. And you are doing whatever you do for a living, whatever it is, I guarantee, if you're on here and you can afford to pay the freight for $25 million and your loved ones care, great. But now you're going to be the person, because somebody had inadequate insurance, you're going to be relying on Medicare I don't want my loved one having to rely on Medicare, because I know what they will and won't pay for. I know what the facilities look like when you have to do that. And that's what you're going to be left with. So if it's legit, who should pay the freight for the big injury? Should it be the entity responsible for it? Or should it be us, the taxpayers? Or maybe we should have a fund somewhere to pay for it?
I was about to say that, Joe. Okay? A fund or a captive. I was with you. Yes.
Okay. So we can talk about this stuff, but there's real issues on both sides. And I think that when you look at the 2 million, you have to put some context. I think it will affect small carriers, the big and medium sized carriers. Let me tell you, I was lobbying for $5 million worth of coverage years ago in DC. And I was joined by some of the biggest carriers. I'm not going to mention their name because I don't want to piss anybody off, but some of the biggest carriers and some medium sized carriers were right beside me in the Congress people's offices, because from their perspective, it's a competitive disadvantage. I've already bought the coverage. Why should I have to compete with rates with somebody who doesn't spend the money to buy the coverage? Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of
carriers running loads. So
most
safety standard.
Sorry, Cassandra.
No, it's okay. It's just that big trucking companies have completely different safety standards. And Brendan knows this, than owner operators. The big trucking companies are forced to have all this technology, all this training, different policies, this, that. And the owner operators can just pop in and go.
Aren't most owner operators, don't they end up leasing on to somebody?
They can lease on to multiple companies.
Yeah. Most of them are leasing on to somebody though.
Yeah. I mean, that's definition of an owner operator.
Right. Somebody's saying, Joe, no, nope.
They're not often leasing on to like the Schneiders or the Swifts. You can lease on to anybody with an MC number.
So I think that's what ends up happening. And you may not like the answer to this, but you asked what I think happens. First of all, I think the industry, the trucking insurance industry adjusts to the new rates just like they would any other rate change. And it's not fair to say rates will go up by 200 or 300%. They're going
right.
to ends up being something that adjusts over the whole industry. So good companies pay some for bad companies. And it ends up being something along those lines. But if you can't, I'm sorry, I'm going to piss some people off by saying this.
Oh, say it.
If you can't pay for a $2 million insurance policy, I just question whether you ought to be running an 80,000 pound truck down the road and subjecting my family to the damage that you can do. I'm sorry. Call me.
How about all the brokers out there?
You know,
the brokers out there end up having to be the insurance companies of the industry. If the carriers don't have insurance, or because they often don't have enough insurance. So shippers will go to brokers because shippers can demand that brokers have $5 million in coverage and all this other crazy type of insurance.
Much fewer chameleon carriers are going to be able to reincarnate on a $2 million number, because there's not going to be a Progressive writing a 750 damn MCS 90 policy to anybody who's got a checkbook. They're going to look at the practices and procedures that people like Brendan have spent a lifetime helping to develop to make sure trucking companies are actually running safe, not just have something that says X, Y, or Z or a policy or whatever, but that they're actually running a safe operation.
This sounds like a culture shift, Joe. This sounds like something where this needs to be a sit down of guys. Right. When is enough enough? We need to reinvent and reshape what was and become what needs to be. That's what sounds like to me. Is that what you're saying, Joe, or am I interpreting that wrong?
You said it a lot better and with fewer words than I can. So you're a
does
much
that
better.
To us often.
I would embarrass you and say you're a better lawyer than me, but you know.
Don't do that. I couldn't be a lawyer. Sorry for the bark. Calm down. Calm down.
So here's what we're gonna do. Joe, how much more time do we have? We promised Joe it would only be an hour, and Brendan's been extremely busy too. How much more time do we have you for, or do you need to go?
I'm good, but I don't know about Brendan.
I'm good.
Okay. I'm good. I'm so good now, for about another 30 minutes.
Okay, now I'm going to really fuck with people.
All right.
Ooh. Yeah.
So, Joe, what is litigation funding? Why do you guys need it? It sounds like a racket.
Yeah. So litigation funding can mean a couple of different things. At its core, what it means is somebody is financing something.
Like,
and they're either financing the litigation, like the costs of litigation, or they're funding the cost of medical care. And the thing that I think most people are upset about, and frankly, I join you in it, is that there's issues, I believe, in the litigation funding having to do with funding medical care. There's some companies that are engaged in what I think are predatory practices in that space. And I think it leads to things being unfair. There are other companies who are frankly doing it in a white hat sort of a way and trying to create a way. So there has to be some way. If I go to you and say, what if you're uninsured, you have no health insurance, and you now need a brain surgery, and you happen to be involved. If you're not involved in any litigation, where are you going to get that? Where are you going to get that brain surgery from? Maybe the government's going to pay for it. Maybe not. If you're a client of a lawyer and there's a lawsuit that's likely to result in a recovery, then somebody might take a risk and lend you money for that surgery, right? And the way they do it is the part that's the problem. The way they do it is they go to the doctor and they say, we're going to pay you cash. So what's the cash price? And so let's say it's a $50,000 procedure. You know, by the way, it's not that different than what insurance companies do when they contract with that doctor to take 53 cents on the dollar pursuant to a Blue Cross Blue Shield contract.
Same doctors?
It's any doctors. I mean, so more and more doctors, you know, from a doctor's perspective, and I'm not one, but I think the doctors would just say, look, from my perspective, it's just another payor. I'm looking for ways to get paid. And they're paying me and they're not making me wait. And I'm not having to take a letter of protection and take a risk on a lawsuit to whether I'm ever going to get paid. I'm not having to wait. I don't have an account receivable. And I actually get the payment before I do the surgery. But here's the rub. The rub is the bill that goes in for my client is the retail bill. Okay. Now that bit, if it was just the retail bill and it was the legit retail bill, I really don't actually have a problem with that, because the way the law's written, it says you should be able to recover the value of the service provided. But where it becomes problematic, and I think some companies take advantage, is that bill gets inflated in a number of different ways. And you end up having something that should be X and it's three times X. And then an insurance company is being asked down the line, a jury is being told down the line, this was a $150,000 procedure. And there's been $50,000 that's actually been paid on it.
$800 Band-Aids. I'm sorry, Chris Jolly just said $800 Band-Aids. Sorry,
yeah, Chris. Yeah, it's that kind of stuff. Exactly. And I will tell you from my perspective, when I have that situation, when I'm a lot of times brought in late in a game to get ready for a trial actually taking place. And when I have that in the case, I cut all those damages out, because I'm not willing to go in front of a jury. To me, at a trial, trials are all about credibility, and I've got to have the credibility. At some point, I got to earn the credibility, and I got to keep it all the way till the end. And so that kind of a thing takes my credibility and crumples it up and throws it in the trash can. So I will give up a $300,000 or $400,000 bill before I go and try to present it if there's been gamesmanship involved.
I asked that question.
Integrity, Joe.
Well, thanks, Brendan.
Okay, good beer. I wanted to ask that question so that people could understand how complex this topic is. It goes from insurance, defense attorneys, captives, plaintiff attorneys, all the way down to how an insurance company pays, to having investors in this type of litigation. It is so complex that it's hard to black and white say, I hate trucking companies, or I hate plaintiff attorneys, or defense attorneys are the devil, which I am, but many defense attorneys out there.
your horns are showing, Cassandra.
Your horns are showing. But I just wanted to make sure that we got the full scope, because that's what JD and I do to Madtropolis, is we hit them with 360 view so that they understand the picture's bigger than what you're seeing when you read one new news article about a verdict. So I think we should wrap up, unless JD, do you have any burning questions from anybody in the crowd? I've seen a lot of these questions.
I don't think I have a burning question. I just think with 24 questions in the Q&A, You got to give the people an hour one of these weeks where they're sitting with Brendan and Joe and give them a midweek show on this. Because this, I've been so silent because typically I have an opinion and I have them, but there's so much here to digest. So I would love, Cassandra, if you would give them an hour or something to just kind of.
I worry that if we go in too deep into different things, we start losing our general population. Which is not our general population. The majority of this is brand new to them. Or they think they knew what they were talking about, and now they're like, whoa. Brendan, what can we do as an industry? We do have these big verdicts. We do have increasing insurance rates. We just went through the last 30 days of really low rates where people couldn't afford to maintain their trucks. Like, what is your general advice to your clients right now to help them with this environment?
Well, I am a very firm believer in the rapid response leads to rapid resolution.
I am too.
And so my advice to the clients is get on it right away. The defense of the claim starts at the moment of the first harmful event. Number one, get your drivers trained, because no matter what happens, your driver is always the first person and often the only one on the scene representing your company. So make sure they're doing everything right at the scene. Review all of your policies and review all of your policies and check them against everything that Joe Fried's ever written. For example, and we touched on it earlier, don't call them a trainer if they're going to be in the bunk, because a trainer has to be on duty. And if they're in the bunk, they're not a trainer, they're a co-driver. And so things like that, little cheats that we're trying to make so that we can get a little more efficient use out of a mile in an hour. And here's a big one. And there's a lot of my motor carrier friends are really not going to like this. It's reconsider the way you're compensating your drivers. In what other industry in the United States are we allowed to pay a worker by productivity and then limit the amount of productivity that worker is capable of accomplishing in a day?
Jeez.
So that's the number.
Sharecropping.
Yeah, I feel like we should have a whole show on I didn't expect them to.
Brendan, you've either been reading me or I've been reading you. I've been saying for almost 15 years that all the incentives in the industry push all anything that can go wrong gets pushed to the person who can least afford it, the driver. Mm-hmm. And when you pay people the way you pay them, they become, it's a new kind of slavery. I mean, it's just indentured servitude.
It is. Yeah. You talk about a driver turnover, you know, or I'm sorry, we talk about a driver shortage. And again, I'm at risk in my marketplace here, but do we have a driver shortage or do we have a turnover problem? Mm-hmm. Are we not keeping drivers behind the wheel? We're feeling good on a good day at 95% turnover. And at what point in this process are we going to ask ourselves as motor carriers, why can't we keep people in the chair?
Yep. Damn, we need to have a whole show on that.
I'm
driver pay, driver turnover. And
I mean, because what they just said is true. Think about it. That's what I said at the beginning of the show. Oh, the driver is so important. Oh, the driver is the lifeblood of our company. Oh, the driver is so amazing. And you hear all these companies say that. And then when you look at how you truly treat the driver, you realize you treat the driver like shit.
You put them in a shoebox. You make them live in a shoebox and shower in a public place.
The companies that don't treat them like shit don't have driver shortages.
They don't.
Yeah.
They
don't. That's a good point, Joe.
Why'd you guys dropping bombs right at the end of the show? Oh my God,
I can keep up now. No, you guys aren't talking smart lawyer stuff. I had to learn first. Now I can just talk about the race.
We can pull in from LinkedIn if you want, and we can go live. I don't know. It's up to you, JD, what you want to do, or we can wrap up. But
look what Ron just said.
Ron says that, but carriers use driver's pay and the shortages as reasons to increase the rates. It's bullshit. That's one of our shippers, and that's true.
Mm-hmm. I'm ready. It's whatever you want to do. I mean, I'm enjoying this conversation, but I do think you got to give them some more time to.
Yeah, I think I need to give people time to digest. This was a lot. So here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna play this song. JD loves this song.
I do like that bass line.
You guys now know who your experts are, so you know who to reach out to. And thank you, Brendan. Thank you, Joe. Joe, you both are just amazing.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to get thousands and thousands of views, and you guys are going to have a lot of new fans. Joe, we hope you come back. Brendan, keep with us. Stay with us. We're going to have you back again. We need to talk about this compensation issue. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate it a great deal, Cassandra.
Cassandra and JD, thank you for doing what you're doing. And Brendan, thank you for doing what you're doing.
Keep on fighting the good fight.
Yeah.
Keep bringing beer, people.
I do appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Place for you.
Well, I'll make sure to send you that request.